Welcome to the Scary Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical applications that you can take into the office to help you protect your organizations.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
If I had $3.6 billion in stolen crypto, I would not be living in the U.S. just waiting for somebody to pick me up for having stolen crypto.
Yeah. Well, as Hans Gruber said, you know, when you steal $600, you can just disappear. But when you steal $600 million, they will find you unless they think you're dead.
$3.6 billion could probably buy that.
All right. So the first article we have today is ID.me says it will make facial recognition optional for government agencies. And this comes to us from Gizmodo. I thought the way that they titled this was kind of interesting, to say that ID.me is going to make it optional for government agencies, as if they were going to dictate to the government, oh, well, you don't have to do this now. We're going to make it an option for you, you know, versus the government agency and saying, well, we're not going to use that option. So that was kind of weird in the way that they titled that.
Well, I mean, if they had a contract, that might be possible. It's kind of like how the government has contracts with various prisons where they're required to keep the prison 95% full or they pay for it. Yeah. You haven't heard about that?
No.
Yeah. They've got contracts where they have to keep the prisons full.
Oh, you just made me sad.
I'm sorry.
That's terrible.
It really is.
Yeah, but you can understand why those people lobby for drug laws.
Yeah, it's weird. So weird.
But ID.me is, according to the article, is used by 30 states and 10 federal agencies. So this is the article doesn't get into which 30 states or which 10 federal agencies, but either way, that's a large number of organizations in the government that have subscribed to this service.
This is freaking dystopian horror show stuff.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is that, you know, this gives you the impression that they were able to get this stopped before something went awry. But apparently the IRS has already sent 7 million Americans to do this facial recognition stuff before they scrapped this whole plan. So the ID.me says that on 1st of March, they will delete all the face scans they have for these 7 million Americans already.
They've already got 7 million. Oh boy. What are the chances? What do you think the chances of that they actually delete that out of the database?
I think relatively high, but I think what's unstated though is what they do with the data while they have it.
Yeah, that's fair. I was going to say, yeah, they may delete that database, but how many copies of the database, you know, the NSA is going to get one and the CIA is going to get one and the FBI is going to get one.
Yeah. Or how much information have they gleaned from that scan that they're using to better their algorithm or that they're going to translate into some other data points or who knows. Yeah. I don't know. Don't trust the government or the vendors. This comes out right after the IRS said that they were going to scrap this facial recognition thing. And they did this really in response to outcries from the American Civil Liberties Union and other civil liberties groups, as well as multiple United States lawmakers and other groups on top of that. So this was, you know, there were rare exceptions to the outcry that saying this was a bad idea.
I like that there's something that we can agree on in this time of, you know, political strife.
Yeah, I think this is the facial recognition thing. It's something that I think a lot of people, it's just something that the common man can hear about and say, I don't like the sound of that. And I think a lot of people have seen Minority Report, but I guess that was virus iris recognition or eyeball scanning and that, but still the same.
It's still the same. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think this is just, it's something that's easy for the average person to recognize and say, oh, well, that sounds scary.
Yeah. What, you don't want to be tracked from the moment you leave your house till the moment you reach wherever you're going. And the police can be like, oh, look, he's at work right now. Let's pick him up when he leaves at 5 o'clock.
Well, actually, you mean you don't want to be tracked from the moment you get up in the morning until when you go to bed at night.
Oh, no. Yeah. That reminds me. What was it? 1984, where the TVs watch you?
Yes.
Yeah. We're putting these Alexas and everything in our with the facial with the cameras and everything.
Right. And the cops have gotten warrants for the data from those devices.
Yep. Yep.
But what they said, and the reason that they were doing this, and this is a quote from the CEO, Blake Hall. "We have listened to the feedback about facial recognition and are making this very important change, adding an option for users to verify directly with a human agent to ensure consumers have even more choice and control over their personal data." And if you listen to this, it sounds like, oh, well, you know, they've realized this is a problem because everybody complained about it. But there's a subtext here to what he's saying. With in the middle, they talk about an option for users to verify directly with a human agent. Now, what that's the subtext here is you have two options, facial recognition or talk to a person. They're not indicating that there's any in between here, which is complete bullshit, because there are multiple different ways that you can do this type of automation without having to put a person in the loop. Because there's two things that putting a person in the loop here does. One, it raises the cost of the agency to get this work done because they have to have people to respond. And two, it increases quote unquote customer friction because the person's got to wait on the phone for the opportunity to talk to a human agent. And I could not find the article, which I read about actually earlier this week, where they reference that the company ID.me only has 1,000 people for what they call trusted referees, which are these human agents for people to deal with. Now, if you're talking about a government, 10, you know, just if you just assume, you know, forget about the states, but 10 federal agencies, and these 10 federal agencies deal with a citizenry of the United States of over 350 million people. Yeah. You have 1,000 people to handle these types of calls. This is really a dig for, you know, from this Blake fellow at the concept of not using facial recognition, saying, well, you know, you're going to have to pay a whole bunch of money and you're going to inconvenience a whole lot of people because without facial recognition, you got to talk to a person. Just complete crap.
I don't understand this at all. I mean, I kind of understand that what they're trying to do is they're trying to match a person to a passport or a photo ID of some sort, but I don't understand why they can't do it locally on the phone. Because I'm looking right now at how it works on their website, and they scan the driver's license in or the ID form in, and then you take a picture of yourself and it matches that. Content is analyzed using AI, proprietary rules, and a rich sample document library. So it sounds like it's done at a central server, which makes sense if you're doing a big AI analysis of something. And then you're supposed to match it with a selfie. Actually, maybe I don't see how they can do it. Like I was thinking, when you got your ID card done, they could produce like a hash that's a hash of, you know, the biometric markers of your face or something. And that way they can compare the hash and they don't have to save your face.
Right. But so that would, like your phone would generate the hash and then send the hash.
Yeah. And that way the biomet you're keeping the biometric data, but they wouldn't accept that because then you could, if you broke it, if you hacked the application on your phone. They have to do it centrally, otherwise they don't trust it. I guess I see the point that they really want some way to check people against ID cards remotely.
Well, I mean, the other question is this really going to prevent the fraud that they're talking about or not? Because that's what they're talking about. The purpose for this is fraud. But they won't find that fraudsters will not find a way around this anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's a selfie. So you could take if you had a selfie off their phone, if you broke into their phone, you could send that. Or you could take a selfie of a picture of them. I mean, as we've demonstrated several times that's worked against various biometric things, right? Like a picture of your eye works just as well as your eye.
Yeah, I think that the premise here is unproven, that this is the only way to stop fraud.
Yeah.
And this is Albert Fox Kahn, who's the director of surveillance technology over of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, feels the same way about it. Like this, if, and to quote him, if ID.me agrees that facial recognition is too invasive for some customers, why can't they agree that it's wrong for all Americans? And he goes on to say that if they had this alternative option all along, why did they rely on biometric tracking to begin with? So he's on the same of the same mind that you and I are, that there is no facial recognition or human agent. There's an in-between here that would be just as good. Now, towards the end of the article, an attorney with the ACLU mentioned something that called, or mentions that they want to find out more about ID.me's one-to-many video search feature, which I couldn't, that sounded very interesting, but I could not find anything about.
It's interesting.
But when I was searching for this, I came across an article, Biometric Update, talking about the situation. And according to Jim Nash, who wrote the article, and this is the quote him, many federal and state governments employ AI algorithms, often using face photos scraped by the billion from social media accounts without permission, and usually without public outcry.
Yeah, and this is exactly what we were talking about before. Like, this starts off this way where they're like, oh no, we just want to prevent tax frauds. And then it's going to be quickly used by law enforcement. I mean, it doesn't matter what the government does. Private industry is going to use this to sell you more targeted ads as you walk by.
Well, I think what Jim fails to realize or fails to elucidate here is that there's no public outcry because people don't know this is going on. I mean, if this were in a front page article for the New York Times that the government was, many federal and state governments were doing this by scraping billions of photos, people would lose their minds. I don't think the public are like, oh, well, that's fine. So, but facial recognition is not.
So that one to many you mentioned, I'm looking up on this, and that is a way to stop criminals because that's the one where it goes out and looks at external databases to compare any selfies or any pictures of you they have with the one that you just sent in, your own selfie.
Oh, so this is the one where you send them the selfie and then they go and look at Facebook and Instagram and all these
other
things.
Yeah, is this still the same person? So he said that ID.me's one-to-many check occurs once during enrollment and exists to make sure a single attacker is not registering multiple identities. So I'd also like to point out this article mentions that this is on Engadget, and I'll stick it in the related notes, but it says that it's used by dozens of states to verify unemployment benefits claimants. So basically it's looking at the disadvantaged and the people who are desperate to get their unemployment check and are going to, you know, not be able to pay rent.
Right. So the people who have no choice.
People who have no choice. And the people who would probably be called higher risk for crime by the police because they're, you know, having money flow problems, cash flow problems.
Right. But on a side note, when I was looking for the more information about the one-to-many video search, I stumbled across this RFI released by the Office of Science and Technology Policy in October, which was calling for responses by 15 January. And there'll be a link in the show notes to the whole thing. But this was pretty interesting in that this office was looking for people to provide feedback on proposals for current or past, current, and future uses of biometric data for the purposes of identity verification, identification of individuals, inference of attributes, including individual mental and emotional states. And it goes on to list other things outside of that. But I thought this was pretty interesting.
You're too depressed to access your bank. We're sorry, David. You can't access your bank. You're too sad. You're going to buy something.
No, or you're too angry, so you can't come into the bank.
Yeah, can't buy a gun. You've been angry for the last week.
Yeah, exactly. And what's, you know, and the way, and the...
Holy shit. What if they did that? What if they were like monitoring your Facebook and they're like, oh, you just broke up with your girlfriend. You know, you can't buy alcohol. You can't buy guns. You can't do this. You can't do that until, you know, you've stabilized.
Right. And I think that's really where this is kind of going, which is why I bring this up, because the biometric update, which referenced this article, referenced a response to this from MITRE, which I think without justification really claims that they believe that this question is being asked so that the government can develop a, what do they call it, biometric bill of rights to prevent abuses of this. And I'm really skeptical that the government would do that.
No. The government will, but then private companies won't. They'll just buy it from the private companies.
Maybe. I don't know. The way that I look at it is, you know, the government doesn't give a crap about the Bill of Rights anyhow and violates it every day. So it doesn't matter.
I think we've gone fully down the paranoid rabbit hole with this one.
Oh, boy. But anyway,
take end of the world
take a
podcast.
Look at that article or that paper on the Federal Register about this RFI and read what they have to say in there. Because when I read that, I was like, okay, well, they're trying to find more about this, which is good because maybe they're getting in front of it. And then I thought for a moment, well, where'd they come up with these ideas? Because they may have come up with these ideas because these things are already in the works.
Yeah.
And now they're trying to get out in front of what's already out. So that's really what got me thinking when I read that, is like, they're not coming up with these, oh, well, it could be used for this. I think they're coming up with, oh, it's already being used for these things. What else is out there?
And tune in next week for our episode on Doomer Prepper Rapture.
How to bury 5-gallon cans of food in your backyard.
It's either that or a crypto podcast. All right. So why does this matter? Hell no, the government does not need a facial recognition database of its citizens. But do they already have one, maybe? Or do they have a commercial platform that's already doing this? What if it was stolen by somebody?
Yeah. What if it's being used by, what if that data is being used by other people? I mean, imagine you get down the path of, you know, you look at the way things are right now, that they're talking about smart cities, and the police are photographing people at rallies and protests. And, you know, if someone, you know, whether it's from the government or someone gets in from the outside, or it's a government user accessing this data for their own business or for their own purposes, that, you know, you implement it where you've got a facial recognition of everybody, you've got cameras all over the place, and you could literally watch someone, surveil someone from the time they walk out their door until the time they walk back into their door at the end of the day.
Yeah. And there's actually some really interesting articles. I don't have one offhand, but I've seen them in the past, you know, distributed by both, you know, people putting on these protests and people doing counter protests about how to, like, you know, wear a set of clothes underneath the clothes you wear, you know, wear all black so you blend in with everybody else. Everybody's wearing the same thing. Wear a mask, turn off your phone. Don't bring your phone with you to the rally so they can't track you that way. Park several blocks away. And then on the way back to the car, you strip off the black clothes you're wearing and throw them in a bag so you're wearing something else completely different. Like, there's all kinds of interesting, like, kind of OPSEC stuff to guard against the police being able to identify you. Which apparently the January 6th people did not listen to, most of them.
Yeah. And they're sitting in jail for, you know, going on a year now without trial. And so much for, what was that? The speedy trial or whatever.
Right,
so much
to
for
a
that.
Speedy trial. Yeah. Regardless of how you think about that politically, like, that's still a right that you're supposed to have.
Right. And, you know, with the whole COVID thing, imagine that they put this in place and they're tracking whether you're social distancing properly, or, you know, who congregates, if you're wearing your mask or not. It's just, this cannot, the possible abuses far by, I mean, orders of magnitude outweigh the benefits from implementing this kind of facial recognition stuff.
Yeah. One of the things that we skipped over earlier about the facial recognition is, if kind of like how the, what was the name of that place that lost all the top secret information about the clearance?
That was...
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Office of Personnel, Office of
OPM.
OPM, yeah.
Office of Personnel Management.
Yeah. So let's say they did have a facial recognition database or biometric database of all the top secret people. But then the government, if let's say a hostile government that we won't name, decides that they need to find out where some of these top secret people that, you know, maybe specialize in nuclear weapons live. And now they could probably take the address. It's probably easier to do it that way. But if they're actually protected, they could then, you know, run the facial recognition through, you know, let's say they live in Boston, then they can break into the city of Boston's, you know, CAM network, and they can do surveillance remotely with automated facial recognition. They don't need to send anybody to follow him. They're just like, all right, he goes to the coffee shop every morning at 9 a.m. Let's grab him on his way out.
Right. And the whole thing with this, the ability, the reduced friction in the ability to conduct surveillance is kind of goes against the whole concept. Because one of the reasons you don't want to reduce friction to this level is because it makes them easier to go and conduct this type of activity versus having a real justification, real probable cause that they're willing to spend the man hours in conducting it. Because it used to be, you know, back in the day, if you wanted to follow someone, they would have to say, okay, well, this is cases, you know, and coming from a police perspective, this case is important enough that we're going to put an officer to follow this person around 24/7 for a week to find out what nefarious activity they've done or are going to do. Yeah. Whereas they can say, oh, well, that guy, he looks funny. I think we'll put him under surveillance. And that's all they have to do. They don't have to justify spending the number of man hours necessary that they would back in the day in order to do the surveillance.
Can you imagine? They would actually, now that I didn't even think about that, but automated law enforcement based on this, you could throw a camera on an intersection. And every time somebody crossed against the light, you could be like, bam. That's John Smith at Throw and send him an email or send him a ticket by mail. You know, every time somebody littered, every time somebody smoked and they weren't allowed to smoke because it was in New York or California.
Right. Well, this kind of goes along the lines of, you know, you've heard the book Three Felonies a Day, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm familiar with it. Yeah, that everybody breaks the law, even when you try really hard not to. Like sometimes you speed a little fast. Sometimes you didn't notice the stop sign.
Right. Now imagine a United States in which people commit three felonies a day, whether they realize it or not, and the government prosecutes all of them.
Yeah.
Because they can.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't even that worried about that. I was just imagining the future where, you know, it becomes a crime to, you know, talk about the party in power. You can't talk anything ill about Republicans or you go to jail. And now with facial recognition and sensitive microphones, they can tell anywhere in the city that you walk, like, oh, you know, he whispered, you know, F Republicans, bam, in jail. But yeah, that other's a problem too. Because again, if there's so little friction that they can prosecute literally every crime that occurs within view of a camera. Yeah. It's super cheap, super cheap for the government, right? They just said it's just the cost of sending you a ticket or, you know, sending a cop to arrest you. Depending on how bad it is.
and you know, the worrisome thing about this, and that this is, you know, based on my own view of how the whole COVID thing has come down, is that the number of people who would resist that is really small. So a lot of people would just fold and not fight back against that kind of thing.
You're not wrong. I've actually thought myself, like, what would happen if an openly fascist person somehow took over the US? Like, would I just keep my mouth shut and, you know, keep working and making money and just shutting up? Because standing up against that kind of issues is, I don't know.
Maybe it's a high price to pay. And whenever I think about that, I mean, I'm uncertain about, you know, my own ability to do what I think is right in light of that kind of thing. But I always try to think back to, can't remember what the fellow's name was from Germany who said, you know, first they came for the communists and I wasn't a communist, so I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
And eventually they get all the way to the bottom where you're at.
Yep.
And some people aren't at the bottom. They're in the middle, but they'll get there. So what can you do about it? Well, you should absolutely write to your congressman because that's going to make a difference.
I mean, it will if enough people whine.
I mean, absolutely. Totally make a difference. But to what we were talking about a second ago, don't submit. You know, you have to draw a line somewhere. And I think this is a good place to draw it. And based on the outcry from people on this issue, I think you won't be alone in saying that, you know, I'm not going to put up with this. And you can see examples of people being successful at this in recent history, you know, with the Canadian truckers and the pushback they're doing in Canada and the success they're having there. And to go all the way back to the Revolutionary War, I think as Benjamin Franklin said, you know, we either hang together or we hang separately. And we have, you know, there are more people who are against this than for it. So it's just that everybody who's against it needs to actually stand up and be heard that they are against it and they won't put up with it or to resist it. And of course, if you're an IT person, whether you're in security or just in IT, you know, don't facilitate this kind of stuff. Both IT and security are in high demand right now. You don't have to work for a company that does this. You can find someplace else to work.
So, and I will point out that David and I do differ on where the line is exactly. He thinks the line is masks, and I think the line is biometric databases by the government.
Oh, I think
you got my line too far back.
my line is way out farther than that.
That's fair. But we definitely both agree that this is too far.
Yeah, all right. Give them an inch, they'll take a yard.
Yeah, they're never going to quit, are they? All right. Second one is a little more fun. An article from Vice on Fed's arrest couple who allegedly laundered $1 billion in stolen Bitcoins. Kind of the background here. In 2016, a crypto exchange called Bitfinex was hacked and 120,000 Bitcoins were stolen, which at the time was worth $71 million. It was a big heist. Now 120 Bitcoins is worth almost $5 billion.
Oh, I can't imagine that. That's crazy.
That's so much money. So through chain analysis, the government was able to track the coins into a wallet or wallets owned by a couple, Ilya Liechtenstein and Heather Morgan. They were able to get into the wallet because the couple kept the keys and the wallet addresses in a cloud account that was accessed via warrant.
Well, actually, it wasn't. So to specify a little bit more detail on the cloud account thing, though, is that quoted in the article, they said by decrypting a file in Liechtenstein's cloud storage account, which they obtained via a warrant, they were able to get the addresses.
So that's actually interesting.
The keys.
The decrypting a file part's actually really interesting, because if it had been decrypted with a really robust algorithm and a complex password, they shouldn't have been able to decrypt it.
Right. So I don't. I think that's the curious part for me is how they decrypted the file, because brute forcing decryption or encryption is non-trivial.
Yeah. When the password's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Oh. Man, now I got to change my luggage.
So 20% of the Bitcoin had already been laundered and was gone, but they seized the remaining 94,000 coins valued at $3.6 billion. And kind of the interesting thing here is not that they arrested them, but what I thought was really interesting was how they traced it. And in this article, and also there's another Wired article I linked, they described in very general methods how they traced it. The stolen coins were sent to what they called an unhosted wallet. So I assume that's maybe either a hardware wallet or a wallet on somebody's workstation or laptop. They're sent to an unhosted wallet until January of 2017, when they were sent to an account in the darknet market Alphabay. And at the time, Alphabay apparently operated a mixer service. So they used their mixer service to kick in the stolen Bitcoin and come out with clean Bitcoin. Although frankly, with that many Bitcoins, I don't know how well mixers work for really large transaction sizes. Anyways, they sent it out of Alphabay to 7 separate accounts. So they broke it up into some smaller transaction sizes. Then they used some form of automation to send it to a bunch of different unhosted wallets over a bunch of different very small transactions, trying to confuse the ledger and make it difficult if somebody, I imagine it would be really difficult if somebody was following it manually. And then finally, it ended up in the wallets that were in this couple's cloud storage account. I guess we can't technically say that they own the wallet, but they were in possession of the wallet.
Now, these 5 steps, are these 5 steps taken on the 3.6 or the 1.4?
I think this has to be the 3.6, because they definitely said that it went to this couple. So it has to be the ones that weren't successfully laundered.
So what I'm trying to figure out is so it was sent to the unhosted wallet until January 2017. So that means the whole 120 would have been in that wallet, right?
Yep.
So where did the other, you know, 1.4 billion go?
You know,
where they actually were not able to trace that.
It doesn't say. It does not, nowhere in the steps. They've got a screenshot of the steps from the statement of fact. And it doesn't say anything about the other. And then let me see. There's also a description utilizing computer program. So here's the following techniques they use. They used accounts set up with fictitious identities. They moved the stolen funds in a series of small amounts with thousands of transactions. They used computer programs to automate transactions. They layered the stolen funds by depositing them into accounts at a variety of VCEs. I think that's virtual cryptocurrency exchanges and darknet mm-hmm. markets, and then withdraw the funds. They converted Bitcoin to other forms of virtual currency, including anonymity-enhanced virtual currency, which they mentioned elsewhere as Monero. And they used US-based business accounts to legitimize the activity.
Do you know what I think happened?
Mm-hmm.
And this is obviously complete speculation on my part, is that the 1.4 went to a different mixer.
Maybe.
That was not as, I don't know if you want to say, vulnerable as Alphabay was. Enforcement getting their hands on it.
Well, actually, no. Here, so I'm looking at this. I'm looking at the steps and the direct step three. I mentioned it was sent to 7 interconnected accounts, but it actually, the exact is to 7 interconnected accounts at a usual, as a US-based VCE, which again, I think is virtual crypto exchange, mm-hmm. as well as accounts at additional VCEs. And they're in VCE 2, VCE 3, VCE 4. So yeah, it's possible there is where they lost some of them. The US-based one, they may have been able to get access to the records. So they specifically call out one of them as US-based.
So the 3.6 went in the US-based ones, whereas the 1.4 probably went to the other ones.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyways, it was super, super interesting. And there's
That means they should be able to afford really good lawyers.
Not anymore. They seized their Bitcoin.
They've got 1.4 billion.
Well, maybe. Hold on. Because were they original thieves or were they the launderers? Like, do they have 3.6 billion because that 1.4 billion went to the people that laundered the money for them? Or did they buy the coins at a discount because the coins were dirty?
Oh, so maybe the 3.6 is the profit they made after the 1.4 was skimmed as a fee to do the mixing.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, because it's 3.6 billion now, but originally it was 71 million. So they took off a quarter of that. They took off 20 million off that. I mean, that's a pretty big fee, but although maybe they spent some of it too between now and then.
Yeah, they had to produce that rap video. That was probably cost some $1.4 billion for that, I'm sure.
Yeah. So I find it really interesting that 5 years later, they still have 80% of the Bitcoins. I don't know if it took them that long to launder it. They don't really give any dates for how long everything took other than that first step. But again, like if they're the original thieves, like maybe this was their winnings and they were just waiting and waiting for the heat to die down. But it's been 5 years.
I guess they thought there was a statute of limitations or something. They figured, well, 5 years, the heat's off and we can do whatever we want now. So maybe they didn't even consider that they were at much risk of being caught at this point.
So fraud, statute of limitations for fraud in Virginia is 2 years, but what about theft?
Well, it'd have to be grand theft because it's over 5,000.
Yeah, a little bit.
I don't know if there's ultra grand theft.
Grand larceny is not subject to a statute of limitations.
Okay.
So,
Yeah, see, this is the problem when you get your
degree out of a Cracker Jack. Oh. Yeah, I was saddened to find out that maybe that's not the right way to phrase that. There's no statute of limitations on a number of illegal acts.
I'd say you were surprised.
Surprised, yeah. Now, I'm just curious again, why did they wait 5 years? And why, if they had possession of $3.6 billion in cryptocurrency, why aren't they in a non-extradition country? Why didn't they cash out in some foreign jurisdiction that doesn't care? Like, they didn't have to cash out all 3.6 billion. Can you imagine that? You go to you're like, I'm going to cash in all these Bitcoins. I need you to send me $3 billion in $100 bills.
I don't know if it would crash the market, but man, the market would take a hit.
Yeah. And maybe that's why. You know what?
So why can't they do that now so I can get some Bitcoin?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? That's going to be actually really interesting. Are they going to, I'm sure they're going to try and return this stolen property to the original owner if they can find them. Since it's pseudonymous, they don't necessarily know the owner of the account at Bitfinex, or what was it, Bitfinex?
Was that an American company? Because they probably would have had to have the know your customer law to have that stuff.
Yeah, maybe. That'd be interesting.
But I'm not sure about the retention for that kind of data either. Because if they have, you know, if they had a legal responsibility to retain that data for 3 years, let's say.
No, but there's probably evidence from the crime. I'm sure as part of the crime, they did like digital copies and digital forensics. And hopefully they kept all that data.
Well, you think the customer base would have been part of the evidence though?
Well, they probably did. They probably took a snapshot of the entire server.
Well, you figure if, you know, actually if they did this as, you know, an actual investigation of theft, then everyone who was stolen from should have been identified as a victim of the crime. So maybe they would have it all documented in that way, you know, versus saying that, you know, the people who ran the Bitflex or whatever would have had their customer file or whatever stored.
Yeah, maybe. Yep. So anyways, I thought this was super interesting, mostly for the laundering for crypto, because I know much about it. So I wanted to learn more. Big thing to remember for crypto. Everybody seems to think that Bitcoin and crypto is anonymous. It is not anonymous. It is pseudonymous. I don't know how to pronounce that. We're going to run with it though.
That sounds good.
Pseudonymous. I initially spelled it with an extra on in there. I was like pseudonymous, but.
Pseudonymous.
Yep. Pseudonymous. That sounds better to me. But so basically they can follow the crypto. If you spend a Bitcoin and you receive more Bitcoin, and they can follow it throughout the trail because of the ledger, the public ledger, but they don't necessarily know who owns the wallet unless you've registered at an exchange. There are specific mixture exchanges like Tornado Cash. I think that one works for Ethereum, that they exist solely to break the ledger chain and mix the coins up. They mentioned in the Wired article, I believe, that Alphabay did have a mixer service, but the Fed seized Alphabay. And it turns out Alphabay kept very good records of the mixing they did.
Yeah. So if you're going to work with a mixer, make sure they're like a good VPN provider in that they do not keep records or logs.
I have to wonder, especially, you know, you hear about violent criminals and all that stuff. Like, what happens to someone that owns something like Alphabay when it gets seized and they get arrested and then the criminals find out that it was not actually anonymous? Like, do you get shivved in prison or something? Because that one, I'm sure that led to so many different cases and so many different people getting arrested.
Yeah. Well, what I would say, based on what I know of the organized crime in Russia, yeah, you're going to get an expert. That.
Well, that, I wondered that about these two people too. They got caught with 3.6 billion in coins. If they're not theirs, if there's some other crime syndicates and they were just the mules or the patsies. Although I guess it doesn't sound like it. I don't know. I guess the question, if they were the people who did the laundering or not, because if they were the people who did the laundering and then got caught with them, they just cost these crime syndicates $3.6 billion.
Yep. I think they would want to maybe speak up and get into witness protection or something.
Yeah. Because, wow. Anyways, that's another type of laundering. Exchanging for a different type of crypto can break the chain. Now, if you're exchanging for another type of crypto that is also pseudonymous, and the government can get the records from the exchange, then they can keep following you. So you'll want to use an exchange in a jurisdiction hostile to the US or in a country that, you know, super values privacy and won't force disclosure. It didn't work here. And though they don't explain how they traced it, they did mention it was converted to Monero. And like we mentioned earlier, they specifically mentioned that one of the exchanges used was US based, which strongly suggests to me that they leaned on the US based exchange and maybe were able to get them that way. And as David mentioned, US-based exchanges have to, I know whenever I've signed up at a couple exchanges and I have to send in, you know, copies of my ID and stuff, which vexes me to no end.
Right. Yeah. The whole know your customer regulations and financial stuff.
Yeah. And the Wired article specifically theorizes that they used information about who created the account, because if they know that you created the account and then the money is swapped from Bitcoin to Ethereum or something, then they're like, oh, look at that. And finally, cashing out. You'll definitely want to cash out in a jurisdiction that has poor know your customers laws, or potentially try to do multiple transactions just below the level of reporting, which in the US is $10,000. Although that probably wouldn't work because they can still, you know, combine all that stuff.
Right. Because in 1986, they passed a change to the Money Laundering Control Act with this thing called structuring, which is defined as conducting one or more transactions in currency in any amount at one or more financial institutions on one or more days in a manner for the purpose of evading reporting requirements. So
what's interesting is they didn't put the amount in there. Like if you did one transaction for, or if you did 10,000 transactions for $1, like that counts.
Well, actually the way that this is written, and this is probably just because of my perspective on it, this completely negates the whole $10,000 premise. Anyway, it really removes all limits.
Oh, interesting.
Because if you do one transaction for $5,000, mm-hmm. they could report it because it's one or more transactions.
Yeah, or one or more
amount in one or more financial institutions, one or more days. Because the word one in there indicates that one transaction could be seen as structuring just simply below, because it's below $10,000, which means that in theory, or maybe in practice, any amount, regardless of the whether it's over $10,000 or not, is subject to this kind of thing. But having worked for financial institutions before, there is a cost to this reporting because the government doesn't track this. The financial institutions track it. And most financial institutions, because of the burden of reporting, would not report a single transaction under $10,000.
Unless something else made them suspicious about the
Right, which is usually you see a chain of them. You know, they'll see five instances of $9,000, for instance. They may report that as structuring, but one instance they're not going to. But this certainly leaves the door open for that kind of thing.
Yeah. So the other methods of laundering, one that was mentioned was using crypto and gambling, especially if there's some collusion and making sure the bets pay out, or doing gambling on even money bets where the payout's roughly the same because you're going to win most of the time. I mean, if it's stolen money, you may not mind losing, you know, 5% to the house edge.
That's actually probably a pretty good deal as far as laundering goes.
It's probably cheaper than actual. It's probably cheap.
I'm not sure if I've seen this in movies or if this is stuff I've read in news articles or not before that. You know, if you, let's say you're a counterfeiter, you print up $10,000 in counterfeit money and you exchange it for $7,000, for instance, in real money. So you'll take a $3,000 cut or 30% cut in your, you know, ditching your counterfeit money. So if you're losing 5% on a gambling thing, you know, maybe that's a good deal versus paying an actual money launderer to clean your money for you. Just saying, not that I know or anything.
You heard it here. Go talk to David if you understand. Some other ones that we find out after this didn't work. Using small transactions to complicate the effort of tracking the transactions does not work. The government can track right through that. And using automated methods to quickly make a large number of transactions between wallet does not confuse the government. They can follow that now.
You know, it's like they imagine that a person is watching the screen, and if you do it too fast, you know, you'll confuse them and they won't be able to catch you. Like, pretty sure that's not going to work.
In this day of computers, like if it was like a dude with like a notepad and a pencil, like trying to write down, it went to this wallet, then it went to this wallet, that would work. But nowadays when they can just follow it through the ledger and just automatically like write a script to automatically figure out where it went. Yeah. So if you were, for example, trying to find a wallet that was involved in laundering, like you're working for chain and not chain analysis, although I'm sure they've got better ways to do this now, but you know, you're looking for multiple high value transactions in a short amount of time, immediate transfers and withdrawals of crypto, especially in a new account, transactions with multiple cryptocurrencies on mini account, deposits or withdrawals from jurisdictions with poor know your customer laws, and or one wallet linked to multiple credit card or bank accounts, especially with multiple names. Many of these have been seen in my own crypto wallets because I don't know what the hell I'm doing with crypto.
They're coming for you.
Except for the multiple high value transactions, because I don't have that much money. Multiple low value transactions.
I was going to say your one advantage is all those are like 10 bucks.
But it'll go to the moon and then I'll be 100 air.
Okay. Well, good. So good luck. I hope that I sincerely hope that that's true.
The Chainalysis, which is a clever name for a chain analysis firm, does claim that it can track 65% of Monero transactions And another 20% of the time, it can provide the sender, but not the recipient, which I find really interesting because Monero is supposed to be designed to foil this kind of tracking.
Well, you know, obviously what needs to happen is some technical expert from chain analysis needs to quit and go work for Monero to fix whatever problem it is, which is allowing them to do that.
See, I was going to say they need to come on the podcast and sponsor us.
Oh, I'll say, yes, give us money.
That's so looking at this, CipherTrace is another one of these. They announced it. Their pricing to source Monero transactions starts at $16,000 per year per user for a licensed CipherTrace user.
Holy cow.
So that's not that expensive.
Who the heck is paying that? Of the government. It's got to be all government all the time.
Yeah, because nobody else cares about it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
They have one customer and they're charging them $16,000 a shot for it.
Yeah, they've got multiple customers. There's multiple governments.
Well, from your perspective.
That's fair. Well, no, as long as selfishness rules, there will always be multiple governments because none of them want to share and they all want to be in charge of their little fiefdom.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose you could say that, you know, all those kingdoms worked for Sauron, but they weren't Sauron. So I suppose you could call it that.
No, I guess, no, you're right. It is a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy of people that all want to stay in power and stay rich, and they're doing what is self-interested to them, but it works effectively as a conspiracy.
Right.
It's just not stated. It's just not, they're not in meetings being like, how do we keep the man down? How do we keep our boot on his face? They just all know whatever keeps them rich, keeps the boot on his face.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a happy coincidence.
It's a happy coincidence. All right. Why does this matter? It's getting harder and harder for criminals to cash out their crypto. And that means it's also going to get harder and harder for anybody who believes in privacy to keep their transaction secret, whether that's because they are trying to ignore laws that they don't believe in, or they just believe in privacy and they just want to keep the government out of their nose. It's getting more difficult. And unfortunately, it looks like cryptocurrency is probably not going to be the answer we hoped it would. So, and especially if the monetary amount is high enough that the government is not going to give up. Apparently $5 billion is the limit right now. I'm sure the next one, you know, maybe for a billion, they'll keep pursuing it.
Yeah. I think this just happened to be 5 billion. I think if it were one or actually a few hundred thousand or a few million, they would probably still be high enough for them to go after.
Which is interesting, given that I think they said there was something like $14 or $15 billion in cryptocurrency related fraud and rug pulls and stuff like that last year, scams.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so, just amazing how much money the criminal enterprise is collecting.
Yeah, and here I am working a regular job like a schlub. What an idiot. Well,
I mean, it's like the guy said in Mafia 2, I know one thing, and that's a working man's a sucker.
Did you see did we ever talk about Freakonomics, about how low-level drug dealers make about the same amount as they would at McDonald's? They make basically minimum wage.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They're working men too. And there's
I mean, it's kind of like the... I and this may be an unfair comparison, but they're like the high school or college athlete that thinks they're going to make it to the NFL.
Because if you're at the top of the pyramid there, you're making all kinds of money.
Yeah, because I mean, they're making millions, if not billions of dollars at the top of that pyramid. So if you start at the low level, you think you're gonna move up to the big leagues.
That makes sense. All right,
and then finally, maybe your only option. You know, McDonald's might not be an option where you're at.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a big win or a big loss if you do that versus going to college and, you know, getting a white collar degree in something like business, which is just going to be steady. You're just going to be steady in the middle, unless you're a CEO. I guess that's actually kind of the same thing. All the people trying to be CEOs, most of them aren't going to get there, and they're going to make still the fail case for that is better than the fail case of being a drug czar.
Right. Yeah,
that fail case is you get shot in the face. Anyways, so we have one last point in here. I was curious when the government puts all this Bitcoin out for auction, if it'd be enough to drive down the price temporarily. But David mentioned that this is stolen property and therefore it should probably go back to the people it was stolen from, which I bet makes the government real sad.
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to take place, though. But I don't know if you noticed or not who in law enforcement actually conducted this exercise.
I did not.
The IRS and the FBI. Really?
Interesting. So they're just going to keep 40% of it and be like, we're just going to keep this for the taxes that you guys, so you don't have to pay it this year.
Well, imagine that they do that though. They say, oh, well, when it was stolen from you, let's say you were one of the capital gains, right? Right. Yeah, exactly. You're one of the customers. You had a Bitcoin and the Bitcoin then was worth X amount and it's worth this amount now. You have to pay capital gains tax on that difference now.
Mm.
Wow. I mean, do not put it past them to get money from you. You're talking about the IRS here.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely should go back to who it was stolen from. Because of my lack of faith in the government, I'm skeptical that that'll take place. But on the selfish side, hopefully it won't. And they will dump all that $4 billion worth of crypto on the market at the same time. So the price will come down and then I could get some more.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, because I mean, actually, I guess the question would be, you said it's 94,000 Bitcoins, right? But I think there's, 17 million in circulation? Or what's the, it's on Coinbase has the market cap listed.
19 million Bitcoin.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if 94,000 is going to make a dip in a market cap of 19 billion. So I don't know. I'm hopeful, but Bitcoin, I'm not sure if that would either.
Bitcoin transactions per day. The current level of Bitcoin transactions per day is 260,000 Bitcoins per day, according to Y Charts. So that's an appreciable fraction of a daily, but yeah, that wouldn't be, that'd be a pretty big blip on one day if they set them up for auction.
Yeah. So unfortunately, I don't think it's going to really gonna help us out any.
Dang it. Can you believe it? 5 billion or 4 billion in Bitcoin is a blip in the...
Oh man, that's good. So what's that mean? That what's the total amount, total value of current Bitcoin circulation then?
I don't know. Let me get out the calculator real quick. So it said there's 19 million. I rounded up. It wasn't exactly. It was like 18 something. But times, what is it, 43,000 now?
Roughly.
817 billion.
Not even a trillion?
Not yet. It was at 60,000, it would have been a trillion.
Oh, okay. Well, shit, that's, I mean, that wouldn't even pay for the Department of Defense.
Yet.
Okay, so we're still talking about trivial numbers.
Trivial numbers. Psh, it's nothing. All right, you want to take us out?
Certainly. Thanks for listening to this Curious Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Serengeti Sec and download and this goes on your favorite podcast app. And buy Bitcoin.